Lunch with Leon is brought to you by Total Care, the UK experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Visit totalcare.co.uk and learn about their market-leading mobile column lifts, fixed post lifts, brake testers, inspection pits, and more. Total Care, lifting business one vehicle at a time.
And welcome to Lunch with Leon, where I invite you to lunch with me and one of my friends from around the world of transport. Today, I'm joined by the Chief Executive of Transport Focus, Anthony Smith. Transport Focus is the independent watchdog for passengers, sponsored by the Department for Transport. Interpreting research is one of Transport Focus's major contributions.
And the problem is that even if you said about the 50p, people would still say, oh yeah, I want to pay more tax, I really do. They're lying. They do not want to pay more tax.
Transport Focus's history can be charted back to 1947, when the Central Transport Consultative Committee was formed. For some time, its interest was chiefly on railways, but in 2008, it was extended to bus passengers as well. It conducts significant research and makes strong representations for improvements, including better coordination of roadworks and easier access for disadvantaged passengers to claim their refunds. And I spoke to Anthony Smith on the day new research suggested improved satisfaction from rail passengers.
89% of rail passengers are satisfied with their journey, you've announced this morning. That's good news for us, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think the railway has had a good crisis. It's had a good pandemic. It was there, admittedly massively supported by the government, but it was there for people when they needed it. It's there to help with the recovery. And I think as long as the basics are kept in place in terms of reliability and cleanliness, visibility of staff, the railway will in future cater for a very different market, but is clearly going to be part of Britain's transport mix.
So it's going to be a bit like going back to the Victorian era, isn't it, when leisure travel was the dominant feature of the railways?
To a degree, I think the Victorian railway was very much built around freight and shifting stuff around the country. And I was always amazed by the fact that Buckingham Palace used to get its butter, I think, from Devon Estates on the same day, and Cromer crabs appeared at the Ritz on the same day they were caught. And I think the Victorian Railway had an astonishing just-in-time mentality, which has been inherited by the logistics sector now. But the passenger railway, yes, is going to look different. We're going to have a lot of leisure, hopefully some more tourism, a bit of business travel, probably not quite so much as we had in the past, because the COVID aristocracy who can Zoom, we like our new freedoms and we don't want to go back to the old madness of commuting. And I don't think the commuter market in London and South East in particular will settle down till next year. I think what the Health Secretary said the other day was slightly chilling, that we may be going back to some form of restrictions. And I don't think the real commuter market will reemerge till next year, next spring, next summer. But it's going to be different. Nobody's going to go back to travelling 4 or 5 days a week. And when you look back to how we used to live, I think it's a good thing, actually. I think it was mad the way we lived. It was bad for the environment. It was bad for our families. It was bad for us. And it was not really good for the taxpayer either. You know, when you looked at those plans for the East Croydon remodelling, you think, if that's the answer, what on earth was the question? Why are we living like this? It's crazy. And I think COVID has done us an enormous favour. It's made us rethink how we live, how we want to travel, and what we're going to do. And that revolution, I think, is permanent.
Whether you call it religion or philosophy or whatever, but it was nature's reset, wasn't it? It sort of said, now you're all traveling too much, you're working too hard, you're answering your emails at midnight, you're doing really mad things, I'm going to stop everything and we're going to build it back a bit more sensibly.
I think it was a terrible warning. I think the abuse of the environment that we were engaged in was wanton. I think our relationship with animals and the way we treat them and eat them was unsustainable. And I think the political discourse that accompanied a lot of our democratic institutions had also become poisoned. There was almost a kind of miasma in the air. And I think that COVID has helped cut through bits of that. And it's funny because when you get significant events, people often say everything will change afterwards. And you often think, no, it won't. We're real creatures of habit. You know, I sleep on the same side of the bed. I read the same newspapers. I, by and large, have the same breakfast every day. We're astonishing creatures of habit. To blow people out of those habits takes a war or a pandemic. And we've just had the latter, thankfully, not the former. But I think it has for some people. But don't forget, we are the lucky ones who are sitting at home, because the person who delivers my parcels has had to drive to the depot to pick up the van, is exposed to all sorts of coughs and sneezes and diseases. And we are in a very privileged position. And I think one of the real political things we've got to watch coming out of COVID is the inequality in the country has widened even further. And people will only put up with that for a while. There's got to be a bit of rebalancing in that, in the inequality and you know, in the exploitation degree of people and the way they're treated. And I think that needs rebalancing as well.
That's interesting, because you and I have zoomed through the pandemic from the comfort of our own homes, and but the real place is plenty of young people are sharing a dodgy Wi-Fi link on the kitchen table, in conditions that are not ideal, and for them it's been a horrible pandemic. So there's one of the cases of the inequality. I mean, for us, frankly, it's fine, but for these people,
well, it's a further reinforcement of the entitlement of the older generations, and it's another kind of fault line through of that kind of intolerance and that kind of inequality. And again, I'm not sure how long it can last, because the accrual of benefits and favours and tax breaks to the older people is politically probably attractive in the short term, but it's not sustainable in the long term, because those young people will vote, and they will vote differently.
They will. And you know, that's the other thing that is pushing us along, and it's pushing us along the green agenda in particular, is the progress of the generations, isn't it? I mean, young people are different in the way they are wired now.
No, I disagree with that.
Really?
I totally disagree with that. I think there are some individuals of all ages who are very green-minded. I think this kind of labelling of the younger generations as greener is partly guilt of the older generations, because we screwed it up, I'm sorry, but could you have a go and try and do it a bit better than we did? And I think it's partly just wishful thinking. My kids are really good little consumers. They will use the bus when it suits them, and they will take an Uber when it suits them. They will take the train if it's sensible, but they're not wedded to any of this stuff. And they want to do the right thing, but, you know, I just think it's slightly overplayed, to be honest, and I think we just need to be careful about that.
Okay.
If you can have trains which are green and electric, and they're wonderful. If they're late, it's a late train. And, you know, we did some research which showed that people said, oh, God, if it's going to be late, I'd rather an on-time diesel than a late electric.
Is that so?
Yeah. You know, and that's just, I think that's pragmatic and consumerist. And I think the green revolution will be driven by consumers to a degree. Yes, government has to do its bit, but it's driven by consumers making choices based around value for money, convenience, cost and control, you know, the classic things that govern how we choose to travel. And all my observation of younger people is that they are incredibly pragmatic.
Well, that's interesting, because, I mean, you are right. We have heavily generalized the fact that the next generations will cure the world, because basically we all die off and they will be in charge, and they've got much better green credentials than we have. But actually what you're describing is that's an illusion.
I think it is. And it's what my Insight colleagues call the say-do problem, is that what we say is so different to what we do. And there is nowhere where that is more real than in the environment. If somebody says to you, Leon, do you want to save the planet? You're not going to say no, are you? And so this attitudinal research, utter waste of time. Leon, would you like to pay some more taxes to save the planet? Ooh, ah, no, actually, I'd rather somebody else did. And I think we're just hitting the buffers big time now of the gap between say, do, and the fact that we all know underneath we're going to have to change the way we live.
Right on say, do, and you remember my first-hand experience of that. I got caught up in TfL in this huge push that public transport workers should have a bonus for the Olympics. And of course, the research was on that basis. Stop people in the street. Do you think the bus driver should have a bonus for the Olympics?
Yeah, cool.
The question should have been, would you be prepared to pay another 50p on the fare so the drivers can have a bonus?
Yeah.
Of course, wasn't the question. So we see that all the time.
Yeah, and the problem is that even if you said about the 50p, people would still say, oh, yeah, I want to pay more tax. I really do. They're lying. They do not want to pay more tax. And so government's got to do its bit. It's got to provide the direction, the taxes, the incentives that push people in the right direction. But tomorrow, if we all decided, actually, we're not going to buy supermarket plastic-wrapped fruit and vegetables, it would be solved overnight. You know, these systems only exist on the consensus of the majority. And the moment the consensus shifts, it's moved, it's gone. And we're not there yet. I think things are changing faster now. The consensus on things is changing faster than I've ever seen in my life, which is exciting. You know, there's a clear COP is helping. The visible manifestations of climate change are helping. There is more change, but there's no such thing as guilt-free flying. You can't carry on just driving diesel cars around. You can't. You've just got to stop. And we have to change the way we live. And after 120 years of land use planning that's been based around car-based transport, it's going to take quite a bit of time, frankly, and quite a bit of thinking and quite a bit of radical engineering to sort some of this stuff, because I don't believe the tech promises. You know, I don't believe the tech breakthrough are the things that are going to save us. I'm slightly nervous about that. No. I think we've probably got the tools today to do it, and we should just crack on.
You must see a lot of misinformation. And the one that's doing the rounds at the moment, of course, as when we record this, we're just hours away from the wider ULEZ in London. And only in the last week, I had a guest at dinner, one of several, who said, the reason I haven't bought a new zero emission or low emission car is, of course, that I'm helping save the planet, because by not buying a new vehicle, the CO2 that would be produced during its construction, the precious metals that we use in its construction, are all being saved. Now, of course, that is just not true, because the lifetime cost of vehicles, it's almost true if your country is very heavily reliant on coal for electricity. So in Poland, it's nearly true that you're better off. But in the rest of Europe, it's certainly not true. In the countries where there is more renewables, like Norway, it's certainly not true. But this is the sort of misinformation that goes around, because it's like your guilt-free flying, that the guilt-free use of an old diesel car is on the mistaken premise that they're helping, which of course they're not.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because we did some research recently about post-COVID attitudes to sustainability, transport and consumerism, and pretty interesting focus groups. And basically, people are just absolutely baffled as to what is the right thing to do. And so beyond recycling, which is kind of, you get your head around that and most people do it, although it actually doesn't make a huge amount of difference, actually. People are just flummoxed. They don't know what sustainable means. They don't know what green means. They don't know how to make a difference. They don't know what exactly that kind of trade-off, you know, is it better to keep a diesel car because, you know, manufacturing a new electric one's worse or whatever. People just don't know what the kind of trade-offs are. Aligned to the fact, me walking to the shops seems like a very, very small thing compared to that plane that's just going overhead me now. Coal-fired power stations in Poland with dirty brown coal. You know, it seems a sort of, are we really all in this together? Really? You know, it doesn't quite feel like that yet. And I think people are just kind of confused. And that is where government and the business world has got to step in to help people understand the trade-offs. Because it's classic this week, Boris standing next to the train with this train or trains save 7 million tons of CO2. The problem is, I don't know if that's a lot or a little. I've got no idea, because I don't know what the total capacity of the atmosphere is. I just don't know. And I mean, it sounds like a lot, but I think the messages cannot be simple enough. You know, so I wrote to Andrew Gilligan after this, and I said, look, Andrew, this is great, but what you need to splash down the side of the train is carbon buster. You know, simple. It doesn't, don't baffle people with the figures. And anything that's got an O2 on it is, I'm lost. So I don't really know what it is. So, you know, this is the carbon buster express. All you need to do is make people feel better that they're making the right decision and reinforce it constantly, 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 because otherwise we're all just lost. It's all very difficult.
Yeah. No, and I get that. And I certainly agree with you. People want to try and help, but not at too high a personal sacrifice. And that sacrifice is tax, it's higher prices, and it's going out of their way more than just a bit. As soon as I've got to do more, as soon as I've got to do something quite different to what I normally do, then I'm not so interested. So, but anyway, so that's helped us explore the capitalism for me and socialism for the rest of you argument. is the one that we all have. And the other thing I think I'm really interested in has been the government's behaviour during the pandemic of both saying that public transport was dangerous.
Yeah.
And I think that's been hugely unhelpful, because some of the operators haven't done very well on that either. I mean, some of the precautions that were taken made it look like it must be dangerous. It didn't say this is clean. It says, beware, you know, this is dirty.
Well, no, I mean, at worst, it looked like a crime scene.
Yeah.
I mean, it looked like something out of Scandi Noir, didn't it? It was kind of tape and sort of do not enter. It was awful. Yeah, it's awful.
It was. And frankly, right until the last, the government was pushing this, the virus travels by public transport, beware message, which has been horrible. And I think that's led us, it's allowed a number of people, and I often talk about this on this show, we had got a number of cynical people over the hill in terms of using public transport, just about got them over the hill. The coronavirus has got them back in their cars. And not only has it got them back in their cars, if they've now got a low emission or zero emission car, they've got this smug look on their face that says, I can do anything I like because I'm not causing any pollution. And the fiscal measures. So if you are a company car user, if you lease a new electric car, then you're saving 19% corporation tax on the leasing cost. The benefit in kind for an electric car, for a company car owner, is 1%, not the 30-odd% it is for an internal combustion engine. And so broadly, the government's fiscal measures are pushing us towards zero emission vehicles. Yeah. And at the same time, the Chancellor has no answer to what happens to the fuel duty that's being lost. Mm. And even I know that fuel duty pays for ships and railways and hospitals and schools. So it seems to me the government is doing, it's making a good noise, and COP is a big help on this, but I don't quite see how the government's balance sheet responds to this.
No, I think the pandemic to a degree hollowed out confidence in any form of kind of mass participatory activity. And then, of course, public transport has a disadvantage that if you were going to work, the attractor probably wasn't enough to sort of make you think, oh, yeah, this is worth it. Whereas me going up to Leeds at this, you know, next week is because it's a leisure journey and it's fun and it's the exercise of choice rather than the kind of response to, you know, the man and having to be in the office. But I think it's hollowed out confidence badly. And, of course, it's absolutely shattered the finances of public transport. And I've got a feeling we've probably passed peak public transport. But I think the solution to that is to stop thinking about the silos of public transport versus private and the silos of rail versus bus. We've just got to be far more creative about this, because I think my sense is that local mobility solutions, whatever you want to call it, like scooters, bikes, walking, buses, probably will endure to a degree, because the future is now more local than it was before. So that's going to nibble away to a degree at public transport. I think shared middle distance transport, things like Uber, will become much more popular again, assuming they can find any drivers. And there will be a core of public transport for people who are exercising choice, who want to travel in that way. But I suspect we've passed the sort of peak public transport figures. The railway is unaffordable for the taxpayer in virtually every respect. It's not the railway's fault necessarily. I mean, the system of the last 20 years, the changes in planning, and making it more environment-proof is expensive, expensive, expensive. Everything is pushing up costs on the railway. I mean, I heard the other day that the Portishead changes, £137 million, and it's still not ready to be opened. That's not affordable. I think what is exciting, though, is that the coming together of the rail and bus worlds outside of London, because government now controls rail. Now, government essentially has the power of bus in outside London through the funding mechanisms and the bus service improvement plans that are coming. More creative thinking around the margins of those two is going to be absolutely crucial. We may not be able to afford trains everywhere, but if you have a bus written into a concession, so you know it's going to be there, it's guaranteed for 7 years, it has a permanency and a branding and a through ticketing, it becomes part of the offer. I think there's some creative stuff that can be done around that, really creative.
I'm sure there is. And you know, I advocated for years unsuccessfully that railway tickets to major destinations, major conurbations, was that the plus bus version of the railway ticket, which is the fare plus £2, was the default ticket. So when you bought a return to Manchester, there was another £2 on it, which gave you the plus bus add-on at the Manchester end. Now, of course, only a proportion of people would use it, but the aggregation of all those extra £2, portioned in the same way as senior citizens travel and all the rest, creates a fund for a better public transport service. And frankly, £2 on a price to Manchester is neither here nor there, because whether it's 150 or £152 makes no difference.
I think that's, and
I was always very keen, because on that basis, people do quite like using things that appear to be free. So if I'm less likely to get in a taxi at Manchester Piccadilly if my railway ticket gives me a free bus ride, in a sense.
That's right. It makes you feel good, doesn't it? And it makes you, you know, people like exercising that sort of free offer stuff, and it's very positive. And I think when you add all those kind of things together, you know, the future of cars is quite assured in one way or another. And I've been thinking a lot about this recently, because I think in my mind there were three inventions that sort of changed the ability of ordinary people to live and in different places and live in different ways, one of which was the motor car. You know, it revolutionized transport. It destroyed distance and time. The other was the plane. You can live in a different continent, different country to where your family are. It's extraordinary. And of course, the other one was the telephone and every variation of telecommunications that's come afterwards, the internet or whatever, which destroys distance. I can talk to you on the phone. It's extraordinary, you know, but relatively recent invention. And so you think, actually, those three things are going to endure. Planes, cars, and telecoms will all endure because they make our lives better. They destroy distance. They destroy time. And you sort of think, that's interesting, because how on earth then does transport fit into that? Well, buses are a kind of wheeled thing, and therefore will have a local resonance. But you do wonder, you know, what trains are going to have quite a different future. And it always strikes me that how did the Polish people come to Britain? They came on airlines and they came on coaches. None of them came on the trains, because the biggest failure of the single market, I think, has been cross-border train travel. You know, it's awful. Nobody's going to do it unless they have, you know, no other choice, because it's expensive and inconvenient. And I think if the train's going to sort of alter itself, it's going to have to think quite differently. And the launch of Lumo yesterday, I think, was really, really significant, because you turned the corner into that carriage, all one class, and you just thought, wow, this carriage is longer than the LNER ones, isn't it? And no, it's not. It's the same length, but it's airline seating, comfortable airline seating with a bit more legroom, very few tables, excellent luggage space above, really good lighting, And the crucial thing is you order your food to your seat in advance. So I think they've got a partnership with Deliveroo. And so you can order Waitrose if you want, or you can order Greggs. You know, this kind of personalization of a standard service is what's happening everywhere else. And I think that's what the future of the railways is going to look like.
No, that's going to happen. And also Lubo has been positioned, truthfully positioned, on the London to Edinburgh domestic air market. And I think that's quite clever. I mean, it's no secret it's being done in the week before COP. It's no secret that London to Edinburgh is one of the densest populated air corridors that we provide. Of course, what it doesn't do is it doesn't do the interlining for the people who just came from America or just came from Europe who want to then move on to Edinburgh. That's fine. But for the domestic move of people between city centre and city centre, it looks good.
I think it looks really good. And good luck to them. And of course, they've got no cushion. If they don't sell tickets, they go bust. And they're just like a normal business. It's amazing. And I quite like that. I think that sort of engenders a consumer focus, which is often lacking in lots of other bits of consumer transport.
Interesting you should say that, because I was talking to Louise Cheeseman, the new bus director at TfL, recently. And of course, she comes from Hull Train, which is an open access operator. And she said when she arrived at TfL, one of her mantras was, of course, if we didn't sell tickets, we went bust. Just as you said, she's very keen to make sure that imperative is there.
Anthony Smith, the chief executive of Transport Focus, is having lunch with Leon at itthub.net.
One of the things that struck me recently is that the government has, I think the Transport Decarbonisation Plan was much, much better than it was given credit for. It was the government setting out a tremendously big, complex stall with a very powerful end date. And yes, it's going to be messy getting there. God, it's going to be painful politically, technologically, and all sorts of things. But for the first time, we had a government gathering all the transport stuff together and saying, we're going this way. It's really powerful stuff. And the encouragement to active travel is great, although I always think that cycling is oversold in that respect, because it suits some people very well, but other people just wouldn't go anywhere near it with a barge pole. The encouragement towards public transport is really great, although making that a reality in the current funding situation is a bit tricky. I think getting people to substitute car trips is really hard. As we all know, once you've bought the car, you've lost the argument. The costs are sunk. It becomes the petrol versus the public transport cost. And me, with my senior rail card, my love of public transport, I'm sorry, I take the car sometimes because my partner says, 60 quid? You must be joking. Well, take the car. It's about 10 quid. So I think the concentration has got to be in urban areas on giving people viable alternatives to owning a car. You don't lecture them and say you must never use cars. Of course you can use cars. Use Uber, hire a car, car club, if it suits you, because we all have four events a year where you need a car. Going to the dump, going on holiday when you've got all this flipping luggage, going to the supermarket occasionally, and the garden centre. Apart from that, you don't really need a 4 or 5-seater car.
You might just add to that for certain families, the duvet run to and from university 3 times a year, maybe the holiday in France, whatever. But all that's doable. So I'm an avid car club user. And I have to say, I think one of the mistakes I made in TfL is that there was a point at which we could have brought the car clubs into the TfL ecosystem. And at the time, and the prevailing policies at the time was that we very much guarded the TfL logo and prestige. And it was felt that car clubs were too far on the outside. But what we missed, car clubs gain a respectability once they're inside the ecosystem, in the same way the cycle hire scheme has respectability. Yes. Somehow you know when the roundel is there that it's licensed, it's insured,
trusted.
It's trusted. And I think we should have brought the car clubs into the ecosystem, because once it's inside it, it would have had greater respectability. Now, I'm an avid car club user. There's one outside my door. It's ideal, but it doesn't quite have the penetration. It doesn't really have the acceptance yet, I don't think.
No, and I think there's two things that we can crack that with, one of which is Zone 1 is very different to Zone 3. And I live in Zone 3, and you just watch how people travel at Zone 3, and car clubs are never going to crack it for them to a degree. There's a certain number of people who will always feel they need a car. That doesn't matter. You're not going to persuade them. It's the intense segmentation, I think, of the markets that's going to be crucial to the future, and data will be crucial to that. Right, you're just moving house into Zone 3. Here's your options. You know, you don't need a car. And planning eventually will drive out car ownership because, you know, parking spaces are becoming rarer, cycle parking is becoming better, blah, blah, blah. But I think if we can focus on how you give people viable alternatives to owning a car, I think there's a bit of hope in there, actually. They've got to have those alternatives. So don't pretend you can do this in Cornwall, you know, forget it. But Manchester, Birmingham here, especially where you've got lots of point-to-point transport, and places like Manchester, they weren't very concentric to start off with. And now, post-COVID, they're really not concentric at all. And so you've got to stop having this zonal stuff that's based upon the centre, because that's not how people live. You've got to somehow market transport solutions to where I live and where I want to get to and offer it in a way that's painless. And my sneaky suspicion is that if you worked out for people, okay, have exactly the same lifestyle for a year, and let's see how much it costs you when you don't own a car. And I reckon it would cost you probably, a family, it would probably cost you about $5,000 plus more not to own a car.
Is that
just
right?
Have the same. No, that's my fact packet. I haven't done the calculation, but I suspect the gulf between the two, even with all the car costs added in, there would still be a thumping great difference. And how we narrow that difference so that it's financially on a par or even better not to own a car, I think that's going to be the key battleground for the next 20 years. And it's going to be tough because cars are good.
And does road user charging develop the answer to that?
It must do. It's got to. Everyone, it's the biggest elephant in the smallest room I've ever been in. Yeah. It's got to happen. We all know that you could have carbon taxing across the economy, which would help and might focus people on the real cost of car purchase or whatever. But I think that's such a big issue. You're going to have to pick it off mode by mode. And therefore, the gathering pace of ULEZ, congestion charge, London boundary, Dartford crossing charge, you name it. You know, motoring is becoming quite medieval. You know, there are tolls everywhere. It's becoming really messy. But that will nibble away at it. But ultimately, you've got to auction access to the most valuable spectrum that we have in transport in a more sensible way. I can't keep turning up at 8 a.m. when it's at free at point of use. It can't be.
So, in fact, Claire Haig on this very programme advocated an interesting way into that, which was broadly to allow the existing system and a pay-as-you-go system to coexist. And on that basis, now for a start, if you opted into the pay as you go, firstly you'd get some sort of dowry,
some sort of
payment. Because the people that would opt in first are the people we often forget about. It's the people in Cornwall, in the rural areas, where there's very little congestion, where there's very little air quality issues, and because of the rural nature of where they live, the lack of public transport forces you in the car direction. So then, if you had a big chunk of population opting into the pay-as-you-go, then actually starting to crack it for the urban areas gets rather easier, because once you've got the two systems running, you can start to flex costs and the taxes in such a way as that over time, marginally, more and more people opt into the pay-as-you-go until eventually only a few dyed-in-the-wool people are left on the vehicle excise duty, fuel duty.
I think that's really, really good suggestion, because if you mandate it overnight, you will get the low traffic neighbourhood wars. They will look like a minor skirmish compared to what will happen. It will be like the Somme every day. It will be awful. And to a degree, I have a lot of sympathy, actually, because people that work for a living are being penalised and have to drive are being penalised really unfairly. And of course, they tend to be people who are probably slightly less well off. You've got to have a more nuanced system. And you know, plumbers, builders, taxi drivers, they're all being penalised and they're just trying to earn a living, for God's sake. And, you know, it's regressive and unfair. And I think a more nuanced approach to that is a really, really strong argument, allied with one crucial thing, I think, which is you probably help the private sector electrify its fleets, its commercial fleets, sooner rather than later, because that investment will produce huge air quality benefits very quickly. And, you know, for plumbers to buy an electric van, it's kind of, I mean, you know, it's always going to be a bit marginal, isn't it? But if you help them over that, I think, yeah, and combined with that sort of nuanced system, and, you know, get sort out trucks as well, because everyone hates trucks. And so, you know, you can sort of, you know, sort out the truck industry somehow in terms of charging. And then you can gradually prove that it works. Because what people are probably scared of is the, you know, till one day, you know, minute past midnight, we all go onto a charging scheme and it would be terrifying. You've got to take people very gradually on this journey.
Absolutely.
I like it.
And the other reason to get on with it quickly is you can't have the park of nil tax, nil fuel duty, zero emission vehicle drivers get too large before you introduce it. Because then there'll be a war. Not only will we be fighting Germany, we'll be fighting Russia as well on a different front. Because not only will be the general motorists, they'll be the ones who've invested in the zero emission vehicles, who've got cushioned by the lack of tax and charges, who are a new group of voters.
Yeah, and also don't forget, there will be a large group of people that can't afford the switch or don't want to switch. And I can envisage a future where the government's going to have to subsidise petrol stations, because they're going to have to keep them open, because there will be somebody in 2050 who's got a diesel car. And unless there's a kind of niche boutique market for diesel, they're going to have to get it from somewhere.
Indeed so. And in fact, you're speaking to somebody who, with Sir Peter Hendy, owns a 1949 double-decker bus that will always run on diesel and we will always need to fill it. So, Anthony, look, there we are. What a fascinating conversation.
I love that. Thank you.
Very much indeed. So my guest today on Lunch with Leon has been Anthony Smith, who is the Chief Executive at Transport Focus. So you can check in at the Transport Focus website, transportfocus.org.uk, for all their latest information. This has been an ITT Hub production, itthub.net for all your latest transport news, and of course, details of this and our other media features, including podcasts. In the meantime, thanks very much for joining us. And once again, thank you to Anthony Smith.
Leon, thank you very much.